CPM Virginia versus MJM Hall, Richard S. Phillips, Appellant Counsel, Richard H. Matthews, Andrew D. Kubacek, Kristen R. Jurgovic, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Richard Phillips, and I represent CPM Virginia in this matter. The first question here is, how did we get here? This is the underlying case in this matter is a contract case brought in Chesapeake, where my client sued to enforce an option to purchase after not being paid for a golf course that they had built in Chesapeake and sold to MJM. And we sued for specific performance. We filed a motion for summary judgment. This motion for summary judgment was heard the morning of trial. The judge initially failed to grant the motion for summary judgment on our issue. What happened is there was a counterclaim filed based on recruitment and set-off. But we waived our opening argument, if you will, at that point. Mr. Matthews then got up and gave a long opening for his case in defense or in on the counterclaim. And the court said at the close of that, oh, I understand now what you're saying. You don't really need to put on a case because nobody's disagreeing about those facts. There was a contract. You did exercise your options. And unless they can set off or recoup, you're entitled to do this. So then the case went forward with MJM putting on their case and having the burden of proof to put on their case, because they are now trying to prove that there was a breach of contract, a breach of warranty, and going forward. Now, at the close of their case, I should say, they had presented a big, thick deposition during the course of the evidence. And at the close of their case, we did not put on any evidence. We asked the court to rule, and the court said, I can't rule on anything until I've read this deposition. So he set up a briefing schedule that we would do our argument by written argument instead of doing the argument there. So one of the things that the that MJM has said is that we didn't preserve our right to claim that they didn't make a prima facie case, but we made that point right then when we said we're not putting on any evidence because you haven't made a prima facie case. It's in essence what we said. So the issue in this case is what comes down to this question about, in this case, it involves the allegation of a warranty or an indemnity agreement. In this case, the contract provides no warranty, there is no evidence of a breach, and there were no damages in this case. If we go to the contract, which is in the record at beginning at 212, what we find is that the nature of the transaction is described. And what happened is that CPM Virginia was building this golf course out of coal ash and had to have a use permit and all this kind of stuff from the state to be able to do that. At the point when this contract is entered into, which is August of 2006, what the contract says is that CPM is obligated by its various agreements as set forth regarding the property to construct a golf course thereon, or suffer significant financial penalty through loss of funds as well as possible forced sale of the property at less than a desirable price. CPM wishes to contract with MJM for MJM to construct the golf course pursuant to the previously issued conditional use permits from the city in accordance with the plans as previously submitted to the City of Chesapeake Planning Department. MJM desires to develop and or operate the golf course and is willing to do so subject to the terms and conditions imposed on CPM to develop said golf course, thereby satisfying the various commitments made by CPM.
Your point is this is not just a sale agreement, this is a development agreement and
correct.
A sale agreement.
Correct.
Can I draw your attention to Article 8B, the warranty provision that the trial court held that your client violated? Walk me through the clauses and help me understand if it is understandable.
Well, the only part of it that is not understandable is the third of the three, if you will. The first two, are understandable. But the first thing you said about 8B is that it says except as disclosed in writing. So the contract itself discloses that this is a coal ash thing, you know, landfill, effectively. So my position is that the except as disclosed in writing, in this case, takes everything out that's at issue because it's all about the coal ash. But then if you walk through these, the first is that warrants that there has, during the period that they've owned it, that there has been no use, generation, manufacturers, treatment, disposal, or release, or threatened release of any hazardous substance. That's the first one. The second one is that the seller is aware of no use, generation, storage, treatment, or release of threatened release of any hazardous substance. And then the last one is the one that's kind of really difficult to understand because of the way the commas are in the thing. The seller has not itself allowed anyone, nor to its knowledge has anyone disposed or released of any hazardous substance on or about the property, and that any activity involving the same has been fully compliant with all applicable federal, state, yada, yada, yada. Now, the thing is, if you drop out the parenthetical phrase, the sentence doesn't make any sense.
Well, it says has been fully compliant.
Right.
So that
but again, right, exactly. It's all post, or it has been up to that point.
Past tense and present.
Right.
Well, so don't all warranties always speak as of the date of closing?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And in this situation, Your Honor, you know, what they're trying to do to make this a forward-going motion is take the non-merger language from the end of the contract and kind of append it to this to make it into a future warranty, and I just believe that's not what the law should be at all.
Was there any evidence that at the date of closing of the contract there was an existing, then-existing violation of any reg or any
no,
requirement?
No. There was no evidence. And in fact, if you look at 271 of the transcript, Your Honor, or appendix, excuse me, you'll see that the applicable law doesn't require the closure. There are two different closings: closing on the deal and then closure of the process.
The administrative process.
Correct. And that is 6 months after the last date that ash was delivered to the property, which in this case didn't occur until 2 to 3 months after the closing.
So after the property was sold.
Yeah, so we sold it to them. The day after we sold it to them, they wrote to the Department of, if you look at page 257, the day after we sold it, according to this letter is actually from April 2nd, but it refers to their correspondence of January 31st of 2007. The day after, they wrote to DEQ and asked DEQ to change the rules for this particular property on the conditional use permit from 24 inches of cover to 18 inches of cover. They did. The Mike Waugh part of MJM went, so they knew that there was this 18-inch or 24-inch requirement. They knew all about it. They knew that it was an issue. They knew that they were undertaking it, and they asked the state to give them a different set of rules so it wouldn't be so onerous. And then when, in fact, it is administratively closed, in October 4th, 2007, that's at 261, they send a letter to them that, look, you've administratively closed this thing. Now,
so the only way, logically, your client could be held liable for the warranty provision, Section 8B, is if your warranty extended beyond the date of the sale and beyond the date of the closing of the deal.
Yes.
Did the trial judge, was that properly framed for the trial judge to understand
yes.
that basic point?
Yes. Yes. It was a very, you know, now, there was a substantial period of time from when we tried the case to when the court actually, and we had briefed it all summer long. I'm not sure how he got confused, but he obviously got confused.
May I ask you this as well? Irrespective of the last point, the clause we're dealing with talks about hazardous substances.
Yes, and there was no evidence about hazardous substance in the trial at all. Not even a mention of anything being a hazardous substance.
And not only that, the Dominion Agreement
Specifically says it won't be.
Right, and it isn't.
Right.
Which was their exhibit.
Correct, Your Honor. And I should say, you know, they complained about the way that is. How do I put this? Because they didn't present any evidence that there was a way to extrapolate that there wasn't this 18 inches or 5 inches or whatever inches, but they complained about the fact that Mr. Blake hadn't done. They didn't like the way he had done his certification. Mr. Blake was, however, specifically identified in the second addendum to the contract, which is at 222 and 223, so that they knew. I mean, you know, the letter from the January 23rd of 2007, what happened is NJM actually came in and started working on this property before the closing. So they were already working, and they had written a letter had asked for a letter from Mr. Wallace, who was the managing member, indicating that they had somebody who was going to come certify this property. And they agreed on these five people, and these were the people that they agreed to. So, you know, the complaint that they didn't like the way he did it or whatever is, you know, that's not my client's fault. I mean, and there's no reason to think that what he did wasn't appropriate and correct and it was accepted by the state. So we think that it was appropriate. The regulations, and I'm going to stop here in about a minute because I would like to reserve 3 minutes. The other thing to keep in mind, too, is the due diligence clause. Let me just make clear that the due diligence clause in this contract specifically required them, and the due diligence clause is number 4, and it specifically requires them to come in, and that was originally should have been 45 days, but we extended it to 120 days, and that's by the first amendment to the contract. And it required them to satisfy themselves with respect to environmental matters, soil conditions, and their soul, you know, which is the question of what they knew of that this was being built out of.
If there were no warranty breach, the walkthrough provision, so to speak, is not particularly important anyway.
Correct.
Well, the due diligence is not inconsistent with warranties. The due diligence, they have a period of time to examine the property. Anything they don't like, they can walk away.
Correct.
But once they do close,
correct,
they still have the whatever warranty rights as of the day of closing.
As of the day of closing.
Subject to any statute of limitations.
Correct. Correct. And in this case, we, you know, the true test, in my view, of what they believed is when they discovered 2 years, 3 years later that they thought that, and by the way, there's all this evidence of storms and gully washers and all this stuff. And the fact of the matter is they didn't even plant grass on this property from February until June. They didn't plant a thing. I lost my train of thought.
I was talking about due diligence versus warranties.
Right. So the point is, in this case, the warranties were all past-looking. They were not forward-looking. There's nothing about these warranties that makes them into a warranty of future condition.
May I ask a question about the warranties? The warranties, obviously, as of the date of closing, but then your client continues to work on this site sometime after the period of closing.
Correct.
So what guarantees are there in this contract that you all will appropriately apply the 18 inches after closing and to the date that the...
Well, Your Honor, what I would tell you is look at the contract. There's nothing in this contract that talks about 18 inches. There's zero in the contract or any of the documents that go along with it that talks about this alleged 18-inch requirement.
Well, they talk about compliance with the zoning and planning laws.
Correct. And those require that there be 18 inches
at the closure,
which has to be 6 months later. So that's all down the road.
And that's my question. What obligates you all to, after closing... And
nothing.
Between closure to apply the 18 inches.
Nothing. That's my point. There's nothing in this contract that obligates us to do that. I would point out to you paragraph 5, and then I'm going to stop talking, which is about the golf course development specifications. There was supposed to be an agreement that would talk about who was going to do what, but they never did that. And from the evidence, it appears that MJM took this on. That's why they wrote to the DEQ.
May it please the court, my name is Rick Matthews. I represent Appalee, MJM Golf, LLC. I find this somewhat interesting. The argument hasn't gotten to the collateral source issue, which I thought was probably the major issue in this course, in this case, because quite frankly, I don't follow the arguments, never have, concerning the contract made by...
Can I ask you this, Mr. Matthews?
Yes, Justice Kelson.
Attached to your brief is an exhibit, Exhibit D, which is the VFL agreement. And the assertion was made in a reply brief that that was never in the record and was inappropriate to bring to our attention. I've done my best, as my law clerks have, to try to find it. Can you tell us, is that document you attached to your brief in the evidentiary record of the trial court?
No, Your Honor, it's not. In fact, the issue concerning our supposed assumption of the duties of the flyash, that was never raised at trial. That was never an issue. The issue that was raised is plaintiff sued on the contract, attached the contract without the exhibits, and sued for the purchase price. Then we put in the counterclaim. The contract was put in issue as an exhibit to the complaint by plaintiff without the attachment of this. The reason why it was attached as Exhibit 1 was only on appeal do they raise the issue that, well, we assumed the obligation of the ground cover.
Okay,
it's clear. It's
the
clear.
Argument they have made on appeal, in addition to the collateral source argument, is that the trial court was wrong in finding they breached a warranty provision. And when you start reading the warranty provision, it becomes very problematic. So why would we be looking at matters outside the record to determine a question of law, which is the interpretation of this agreement?
Your Honor, I was just trying to clarify by putting out there the exhibit was there, because when you look at the recitals, the history of this, the attachments to the contract, it specifically says, tells you the contract, what it was, the parties, you know, it's easily identifiable.
I don't want to sidetrack you. It's just generally speaking, whether something's relevant or not, it has to come up from the trial court. It can't be added to the evidence.
I understand, and that's what his argument along this line did. So I was trying to clarify, the contract you put in issue specifically says that our obligations were to finish off the golf course. Tee boxes, greens, cart paths, irrigation. That's what they, which is
the warranty provision that you rely upon.
The warranty provision, when you read the warranty provision, it talks about property and that everything done with regard to the property was in compliance with environmental law and with the conditional use permit. The conditional use permit, which is in the record, the conditional use permit had the same language. It required that all work, and this was they've been working on this for 5 years, getting millions of dollars in revenue paid for taking fly ash on this property.
Is fly ash a hazardous substance?
Excuse me?
Is fly ash a hazardous substance?
It depends on who you ask, Your Honor, quite frankly.
Well, the Dominion agreement that delivered the fly ash, which you introduced into evidence, says it is warranted not to be, and review of CERCLA...
That's correct, and the DEQ allows for utilization of fly ash. And
is it your position on appeal that fly ash is or is not a hazardous substance?
It is not, and the reference in the warranty to the property means the development of the property. They're trying to say... No hazardous substance. Yeah, no hazardous substance, and the property was developed in accordance with environmental law, which required 18 inches of cover. Now, he raised Mr. Waugh's letter. If you look at the conditional use permit, it doesn't specifically say 18 inches. It says cover shall be as required under state law, okay, which is 18 inches. It also says that no more than 4 acres at any time during this five-year-plus project can remain uncovered at any time. If you logically follow appellant's argument, then there could have been 1 inch of cover over 200 acres until 6 months after it was done. That's not the law.
Counsel,
it requires 18 inches.
Counsel, if your contract warrants up to the date of closing, that they have complied with the law, 18 inches or 24 inches, but they continue to work on the project until the date of closure. What warranties, where are the warranties that they have made to you that between closing and closure we will apply 18
inches? The warranty didn't end at closing. If you look specifically at the contract, there's a provision in there, paragraph 5. The parties agree that the provisions of this contract and any collateral contract hereunder shall survive closing and not be deemed merged in the ease of conveyance. Shall survive closing. The way this thing worked is
But those things are not extinguished by the deed. I mean, that's the old doctrine of merger.
Yes, but it wasn't extinguished by anything. The fact is, if you look at the addendum, the amendment to the contract, they were on a contract with Dominion to take fly ash on this property until April of 07. The closing occurred, and this is a 200-acre parcel. The closing occurred at the beginning of January of 07, the idea being that on those parts of the course that had already completed, the CPM had already done its work on, that MJM could get in and start putting in irrigation, cart paths, greens, sand traps, the instance of the course. So the contract had to be amended for CPM to keep coming on the property, putting fly ash, and covering it. And that did go on for several months after closing until they were finished, while MJM started doing its work on the back part of the course that had already been completed and that had already been assured that had 18 inches of cover. You also can't overlook the extent of the breach of the warranty. If you look through the exhibits, you'll find that over 25% of the course did not have 18 inches of cover. You will find that 100,000 tons of soil had to be brought in to cure the defect that that CPM left, to cure that breach of warranty. You will see that 17 out of 18 of the golf holes had to have corrective action with additional topsoil on it. You will see that the only thing they relied on was an inspection letter from an engineer named Buster Blake that could not qualify as an expert, had no experience, randomly dug 20 to 40 holes to test it out, and when we put on evidence out of the gate with our own expert that there was no way that what Blake did could establish to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty what the sufficiency of the cover was. You also know the testimony of Mr. Wallace, the principal of CPM, where he testified at no time during this project, at no time did CPM have any methodology whatsoever for determining the depth of cover. They didn't know. When they gave this warranty, they didn't know. When they drove off the course, they didn't know. Why? Because they didn't care. Yet they pocketed $6.7 million there and an additional $350,000 that was held in escrow until a golf course was built or until they procured somebody to build a golf course. You can't ignore the extent of that breach. And there was plenty in the record for the trial court as the finder of fact to determine that, gee whiz, some random act like a rain or wind doesn't get rid of 100,000 tons of dirt in a year. It wasn't there to start with. So there's no doubt that there was a breach. There's no doubt there was a breach whether you say the warranty ended at closing or it went forward. I submit it went forward, and the intent of it was to go forward. And the warranty was with regard to the property, not with regard to any hazardous material. And the warranty can be read that way and should be read that way. Now, I'm happy to address the collateral source issue because the court below was exactly correct on that. In fact, I jotted down a note when the last argument was heard by this court that you talked about form over substance. Form over substance. Collateral source rule in a contract case, this court left the door slightly open 27 years ago in the Shipman versus Aspinall case and said, well, we've never ruled on it. Came to the same result that the lower court below had done in applying the collateral source rule to a contract action, but said, well, we don't have to apply it because of the provisions of the contract. Here the court below said, yes, it absolutely applies, and I submit to you that the collateral source rule does apply. It's a contract warranty action, and in this day and time, you can have personal injuries personal injury claims brought under warranties, all sorts of situations. You don't put form over substance. You determine the facts of the individual case, and if it sounds in contract, to apply the collateral source rule. And this court left that door open in Aspinall. But there's no way that you can ignore the dimensions of this breach and the facts that's in the record, how broad it was, how, no pun intended, deep it was. I stand ready to respond to any additional questions that the court may have, but I've pretty much said what I've got to say, and the brief is pretty, the brief is there, the record's complete. And I ask this court, to affirm in all respects the ruling of the trial court in this case.
Thank you very much. You have 47 seconds for rebuttal.
I will talk quick. Let me just say, one of the troubling things to me is that the statements that have been made. For instance, Mr. Matthews just said that we sued for the purchase price. Well, that's not true. We sued for specific performance. But then you look in the trial brief, and you go through this, and Mr. Matthews just told you that Mr. Wallace said no methodology for for testing this. That is not what Mr. Wallace said. If you go to 566 and 567 of his in the transcript, what he says is, I'm not the guy to ask. The engineers, Bobby and Lawrence Moyer, are the guys to ask. I don't know what the procedure was for doing that. That's his answer. He specifically says, but there may have been. You need to talk to either Bobby or Mr. Moyer. So, and collateral source rule, in this case, it was an indemnity agreement, and this court should not go out on that limb. Thank you.
All right, your time has expired. The court will take a recess and will reconvene at 10 minutes after 11.
All rise.